This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Turul Mende, the host of the channel, and today we will be talking to Eric Calderwood about his new book On Earth or in Poems, The Many Lives of Al-Andalus. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Maybe we can start with the beginning, like, can you tell us a bit about yourself, how you ended up where you are now, and how did you start writing the book?
Sure, absolutely. I'm originally from the United States, from the Boston area, and I first encountered Al-Andalus at the age of 19. And in some ways, I could say that this book that we're going to talk about today is me trying to return to my 19-year-old self and answer some of the questions that I had upon that first encounter. When I was 19, right after high school, I moved to Spain to study dance. I moved to Seville, and I was in a dance academy, a flamenco academy. This was my first experience in Spain, my first time in southern Spain, where the kind of architectural remnants of Al-Andalus are so vibrant. And I was studying this form of music, flamenco, that all these people around me, including practitioners and my teacher, told me was in some way related to the heritage of Al-Andalus. So I immediately found myself confronted both with this artistic form, with these architectural monuments, this memory of this place that I knew very little about. And at the same time, I found people around me using that place to talk about things that were happening around them, to talk about things in Spanish, not only music, but also Spanish politics, to talk about Moroccan and North African immigration to Spain. I saw this weird, kind of coming together of people using the past of Al-Andalus to understand the present. And really, the past 20 plus years have been my attempt to figure out why people do that and how they do that, what it means to think about Al-Andalus today and to use Al-Andalus to study the present. So that's kind of how I got to this. I came through performance and dance, through flamenco, and through my first encounter with Spain. And ever since then, I've been trying to kind of build the tools I needed to answer some of the questions I had when I first came to Al-Andalus as a young person.
And when you were like, could you imagine as a 19-year-old self that you would one day finish a book about Al-Andalus? Like, what would a 19-year-old self would think about this?
Oh, you know, I don't think I could imagine it. I think at the time when I first encountered Al-Andalus, I didn't encounter it from a perspective of expertise. In some ways, I encountered it as something that sort of challenged everything I knew about the world. I knew very little about Iberian history. I knew very little about the history of the Muslim world. And, You know, earlier today, I was actually talking to an undergraduate who's interested in Al-Andalus, is kind of starting down this path of thinking about studying Al-Andalus. And one of the things I said to her was that one of the great advantages or one of the great benefits of my job is that I basically get to be a student for the rest of my life. And so in many ways, you know, at the age of 19, I had already finished high school. I was about to go into college. Al-Andalus gave me an opportunity to basically educate myself or re-educate myself to an entirely new part of the world that I knew very little about at that time. And so I like to believe that my 19-year-old self would be at least proud that I stuck with it, whether or not I've gotten the right answers, that I kind of followed that curiosity and kind of continued trying to learn the languages and learn about the history. And so that's, I would like to think that my 19-year-old self would pick up this book and be proud that I was able to follow that path and answer some of the questions that I had when I first came to it.
Thank you so much, Eric. And when did the book project itself emerge? When did it develop into a real book project when you said you are going to write about it in like a book format?
Yeah. It's a long story. In some ways, like sometimes I think we should write the biographies of our books because the lives of books are kind of complicated and they don't follow a straight path. And sometimes you only understand in retrospect how you ended up where you were. I should say that I initially started to be trained as a medievalist. That is to say, I started wanting to write about the history of Al-Andalus proper, about the history of medieval Muslim Iberia. And I followed that path for a long time. And in about, I'm trying to think, 2007, 2008, I traveled to Morocco for the first time. I was working on a doctoral dissertation about Islamic law in Al-Andalus. And I went to Morocco to do some research for that and also to work on my Arabic. And that was when I returned to this idea of the ways in which thinking about Al-Andalus shapes the way we think about the present. Because as I was in Morocco, I was encountering all of these Moroccan colleagues and friends who were thinking about Al-Andalus not just as something that they studied in the past, but that as something that very much had meaning to how they understood their cultural identity today. And that was the moment in which I switched from being a sort of someone who studies Al-Andalus to someone who studies the afterlife of Al-Andalus or the ways in which people talk about Al-Andalus in the present. So I could say like that's the moment in which I started to take my training as a medievalist and started to use it to think about things that were happening in much more recent times. What emerged from that book was a book that I wrote, not this book, but the first book, which is called Colonial Al-Andalus, which is about the ways in which conversations about Al-Andalus in the 19th and 20th centuries shaped the colonial encounter between Spaniards and Moroccans. The book that we're talking about today on Earthworn Poems is in some ways a sequel or a continuation to that. I thought of these two books as one project, that is the project of trying to think about what Al-Andalus means in the modern period. And over time, I realized I needed to divide that question in different ways. And so we can talk a little bit later about the organization of the book. But I could say that this book that we're talking about today on Earth or in Poems emerged from that moment in which I decided to make the shift from writing about Al-Andalus proper to writing about the afterlife of Al-Andalus. So that's roughly around 2008. And ever since then, the ideas about this book have been kind of bubbling in my head.
Thank you so much. And can you elaborate a bit about what you mean by the afterlives? What kind of idea is behind this?
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe this would actually be a good moment for me to talk about the title of the book, because it's related to this question of afterlives. So the title of the book, On Earth or in Poems, The Many Lives of Al-Andalus, maybe we can talk about the subtitle, The Many Lives, in a moment, but I'll just talk about the first part of the title, On Earth or in Poems. It comes actually from a poem that was written by the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, in a poem that he wrote about Al-Andalus in the 1990s. And I'm just going to read the line and then explain to you why I chose this line of poetry for the title of the book. So this comes at the end of one of his poems in the 1990s about Al-Andalus. And in the end, we will ask ourselves, was Al-Andalus here or there, on earth or in poems? So the reason I liked this line is because I think it points to one of the central tensions in the book, which is that Al-Andalus is both a place in history and a place in the imagination. It is both a specific moment in Iberian history, the period between 711 and 1492, when parts of today's Spain and Portugal were ruled by Muslims. That's one thing that Al-Andalus is. But it's also a bunch of stories that have emerged from that context, that in some sense have transcended that context and have traveled far and wide around the world, creating new meanings for people who think about Al-Andalus long after 1492. And so what I mean by the afterlives of Al-Andalus is, what does it mean for the memory of Al-Andalus to be alive and have an active social and cultural and political existence long after Al-Andalus as a territory might have ended in 1492? And more broadly, I'm interested in thinking about this tension between Al-Andalus as a place in the past that's firmly kind of anchored in one place in the past, and Al-Andalus as an idea or a set of ideas that have transcended that past and have traveled around the world.
You divided the book into five chapters, and each chapter is looking at different perspective of Al-Andalus. In what way did you came up with these titles, and how did it reflect your research method that you used in your book?
Okay, so the organization is really, it really relates back to the fundamental question that's driving the book, which is, what does Al-Andalus do? In other words, I'm not just trying to argue, like, I'm not just trying to understand what was Al-Andalus in the past. Well, what does Al-Andalus do for people living today? What kinds of political projects, what kind of cultural identities has Al-Andalus made possible? And in each chapter of the book, I try to kind of isolate and explore the history of one way of Al-Andalus doing something, one way of talking about Al-Andalus, and how that way of talking about Al-Andalus has led to the construction of a particular cultural identity or political project. So for example, I have chapters about how Al-Andalus has driven conversations about ethnicity and race in the Middle East and North Africa. I have a chapter about how Al-Andalus has animated conversations about feminism and gender identities in the Middle East and North Africa. I have a conversation about Al-Andalus in Palestine, the ways in which talking about Al-Andalus has worked in tandem with conversations about Palestine in the 20th and 21st centuries. I have a chapter about how Al-Andalus is related to debates about interfaith coexistence. So really in each chapter, I'm trying to isolate a specific understanding of Al-Andalus and trying to figure out, when did people start talking about Al-Andalus in that way? And especially, why has it mattered? For whom has it mattered? What are the people, what kind of political or cultural needs have been served by these different ways of talking about Al-Andalus? If I could just add one more thing to my answer about the organization of the book. One of the things I've learned from working on Al-Andalus is that it's just really messy. It's messy in the sense that it kind of spills over all kinds of geographic, linguistic, and cultural lines. I think if you're trained in the humanities, at least in the States, you're really trained to think in terms of historical period, place, language, national frameworks. And Al-Andalus really messes up that way of working, because Al-Andalus is constantly moving across national lines, linguistic lines, religious lines, historical lines. So I wanted to come up with an organizational structure that did not just present kind of one homogenous story about Al-Andalus unfolding across time, but actually trying to show that at any given time, particularly in the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries, there have always been multiple ideas about Al-Andalus working in parallel at different moments across the world. And so at any given moment in the 19th, 20th, and 21st century, there are many different ways of talking about Al-Andalus that are happening around us. And I'm trying to isolate some of those different ways and show their history, and mostly also show why they've mattered, why they've helped people to create meaning and to define identities in the 20th and 21st centuries.
And did your understanding of Al-Andalus change after writing your book, or did it confirm some of the aspects that you thought about them, thought about it?
It definitely changed. I think that let me just take a beat to collect my thought on this. One of the things I learned about how my understanding of Al-Andalus changed is it changed the way I understand my work. And what I mean by that is, I think we're trained to think in terms of expertise. Academics are trained to think in terms of expertise. I'm going to learn everything I can about this object of study, and then I'm going to master it, and then I'm going to tell you about it. And my attempt to come to terms with the afterlives of Al-Andalus totally torpedoed that model of intellectual work. I would say, maybe this is just what I say to comfort myself, but I've kind of come to terms with the fact that there is no mastering Al-Andalus. There's always more Al-Andalus out there. One of the things that's really enjoyable about talking about this book is, as I've taken it around and talked to different audiences, people always have stories like, oh, have you thought about Al-Andalus in South Asia? Have you thought about Al-Andalus in South America? Have you thought about Al-Andalus in Turkey? There are always different forms of talking about Al-Andalus that didn't make it into the book, either because of time constraints, because I didn't have the tools to work on them. And so one of the things that I learned about Al-Andalus is not so much how it changed my understanding, but it changed how I approached the object of study, was moving from a kind of model of intellectual mastery to a model more based on kind of humility. This idea that I'm going to invest time studying this thing that is always in some ways going to elude my grasp. I'm never entirely going to be able to get my hands around Al-Andalus as an object of study. And I guess you could think of that as like a sad realization, like, oh, wow, I spent 20 years studying this thing and I still feel like there's so much more I could learn. But I actually have come to take incredible inspiration from that. Yeah, I like the idea that Al-Andalus leads to a set of questions that can't be exhausted in any one book. And it leads to conversations that always have other conversations on the horizon. So that's something I've learned more about myself and how I work as I've come to work on this book.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Thank you so much. And in the book, you look at different books and music and films that deal with Al-Andalus. What kind of criteria did you had in choosing the material that you worked on for the book?
Okay, you're absolutely right. If the question is, how has Al-Andalus been represented in culture from the 19th century to the present, which is basically what I'm trying to tackle, like what are the ways in which talking about Al-Andalus emerged specifically in the age of nationalism, in the period of the imperial encounter between Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East, and in the ensuing consequences from those two trends, nationalism, imperialism, colonialism. Honestly, the body of works that respond to that problem and represent Al-Andalus is just astonishingly large. So it was really hard to come up with criteria of selection. I can tell you things that guided my thinking. One of them is that I really wanted to center Muslim and Arab voices. The reason for that is that there has been a lot of energy in the United States, in the U.S. Academy where I work, over the past 20 or so years to think about the legacy of Al-Andalus. But that energy has really been invested in just a very small part of the conversation about Al-Andalus. And largely those have been debates that have been about I would say that the conversation in the United States has been driven by debates about Spanish national identity. Is Al-Andalus part of Spain, or is it somehow outside of Spain? Is Al-Andalus part of European history, or is it some way outside of European history? And these questions are more broadly related to kind of questions of the construction of Europe and its others, and the ways in which Al-Andalus is or isn't part of European identity. Now, all of those questions make it into the book, but I very intentionally decided to leave them to the second half of the book, because it's not that I don't find those questions compelling. I very much do. And in many ways, those are the questions that brought me to Al-Andalus. But I discovered, as I started to dig deeper, that there's this whole world of conversations happening about Al-Andalus, largely not in English or in Spanish, largely in Arabic or in other languages happening. And I was focusing mostly on North Africa and the Middle East, that are only tangentially related to those questions. So one of my first criteria of selection was, let me give more predominance and attention in this book to the voices of Arab and Muslim thinkers and writers and creators who are reflecting on the legacy, and have European writers and thinkers be part of the conversation, but not have them be like 80% of the conversation. So that was one of the criteria of selection. Another one is the version of the history of Al-Andalus that I was taught is one that's very much invested or focused on a specific moment in Andalusi history, which is the history of the Umayyad Caliphate in Al-Andalus. Now, I don't want to go too deep into the weeds here, but just for your listeners who might or might not be familiar with the history of Al-Andalus, for the first few centuries of Al-Andalus's history, so from 711 kind of roughly up until the middle or the beginning of the 11th century, Al-Andalus was ruled by rulers who claimed descent from the Umayyad rulers or the Umayyad caliphs of Syria. And these were rulers who very much identified themselves as Arabs and imagined their political legitimacy and cultural prestige coming from their association with the Arab world and particularly today's Syria and Damascus. So really, that version of talking about Al-Andalus is one that very much centers the kind of Arab experience and imagines Al-Andalus on this kind of east-west axis connecting Al-Andalus to Damascus. What it doesn't speak to are the ways in which there were all these other cultural and ethnic groups also living in Al-Andalus. And so another thing, even after I decided to focus conversations about Al-Andalus on Arab and Muslim voices, I also wanted to make sure that I was including ways of talking about Al-Andalus that were coming from outside of that perspective, other ethnic groups. So for example, I think in one chapter about how North African Amazighan or what we call Amazigh or Berber writers have imagined their connection to Al-Andalus, I was basically trying to think about how other political projects other than just that one of cultural, the kind of Arab identities have emerged in Arabic speaking contexts and developed over the course of the past century or two. So in terms of the selection of how I did that, basically when I was watching a movie or when I was reading a book or when I was sent a new source about Al-Andalus or when I came across a new source, the question I was trying to ask myself was, what is this source's take on Al-Andalus? When it says Al-Andalus, which part of that 8 centuries of history is it focusing on? What are the themes that it's focusing on, and why do those themes matter to a specific group of viewers or to a specific audience? And I really tried to select the works, not so much in terms of what was famous, but rather in terms of what presented a kind of different story, and in following that different story, presented a different form of communal identity that was emerging from a conversation about Al-Andalus. So I don't know, does that respond to your question, or you should feel free to ask a follow-up if I can go deeper.
No, thank you so much. It was definitely answering my question. And I'm curious about how you did find the materials, like what were there like kind of archives that you used, or how did you delve into the material that you get into?
Yeah. Great question. So I would say that, you know, I mentioned that this is a book that for better or for worse unfolded over more than 2 decades of my life. And so a lot of the time that I was doing the research on this book, I didn't know that I was doing the research on this book. I just knew that I was really interested when people would talk about Al-Andalus. And so sometimes people would just send me the link for a film. Hey, I saw this new film about Al-Andalus. I know that you like that. And I would watch it. And I didn't know exactly. It was only later that I came up with a way of organizing the information, not around nation states or historical periods, but around different cultural and political projects. So a lot of it was just spending 20 plus years in a state of deep curiosity about Al-Andalus and letting things come to me. I would say the other thing that was really significant to me was to take my training Al-Andalus, which initially mostly happened in the United States, and then to take that training to other places. Because one of the things that I learned when I started to travel and work in other academic systems was that when I say Al-Andalus, a series of associations and ideas come up for people, and that those ideas vary from place to place. So another really important thing, another thing about my research method, I would say that was really important, was to go and do some training in Spain and figure out what are people thinking about and reading when they talk about Al-Andalus in Spain, to spend significant time in Morocco to ask what are people reading and thinking about when they're talking about Al-Andalus. I also did a Fulbright in Syria, you know, and so like each time I would go to a new place, in theory, I was there to study Al-Andalus, but I discovered that when I said Al-Andalus, a totally different story about it or somewhat different story about it would emerge. And so basically the detective in me would try to say, okay, what are the main stories that people have about Al-Andalus in this context that I'm working in now? And where do they come from? I start to ask people questions like, oh, where do you get your ideas about Al-Andalus? Now, for many people, academics who are trained in Andalusi studies, that might mean a series of historiographic sources from Al-Andalus and some important scholarly works about them that from the past several decades. But for other people, that might mean a TV series. That might mean the novels of Georges Zeidan. That might mean music that they've heard. And one of the things I tried to do was to take seriously the idea that these forms that might not seem to have the same kind of scholarly gravitas, might not seem to have the same intellectual authority as, say, a scholarly book about Al-Andalus, still have meaningful impact on how people understand and talk about Al-Andalus. And so I was really trying to look for stories about Al-Andalus in really diverse places. And for that reason, you find that the book tries to weave together different kinds of sources that don't always live together in the same book. You know, everything from literary texts to TV series, movies, songs, scholarly writings, public events, and so on.
And how does this book situate itself in your overall research work? And for whom did you intend to write this book?
Okay, so it's situated in, I would say, my overarching interest in trying to understand the relationship between the Iberian Peninsula, so today's Spain and Portugal, North Africa, and the Middle East from the 8th century, so from the rise of Al-Andalus all the way up into the 21st century. You know, I said to you earlier in the interview, I started off as a medievalist and have kind of gradually become someone who writes about, not about the Middle Ages, but ideas about the Middle Ages in the present. But I still have tried not to lose sight of that initial grounding that I have. I am actually very interested in understanding medieval history and the ways in which our understanding of medieval history is mediated by stories that are not medieval, that are much more recent. And so I'd say that this book very broadly is inserted in that perhaps overly ambitious desire to understand this, the long durée of these cultural relationships in the Mediterranean world. In what ways have the peoples and cultures of the Iberian Peninsula, North Africa, and the Middle East been in a kind of continuous conversation from the 8th century up into the 21st century? So that's the kind of geographically and culturally specific part of how it fits into my research. In terms of the methodological or theoretical way it fits into my research, I'm really interested in two questions, like how we use the past to understand the present and even to imagine the future. And I think that El Andalus is this really rich case study in which you have this historical moment that has been this almost insatiable or kind of almost kind of inexhaustible well, has created this huge collection of ideas and stories that people have used to understand the 19th and 20th and 21st centuries. And so this project is also part of that, the ways in which history and memory shape our understanding in the present. And then the third way I'd say that this fits into my research project, you know, I'm in a department of comparative literature at the University of Illinois. And the discipline of comparative literature, although it's really, really diverse and has really diversified in recent decades, what really emerged from the idea of how do you compare the different literatures of Europe? And I'm trying to understand what does it mean to perform a serious cross-cultural analysis, not just within Europe, but that puts Europe in conversation with its connecting regions and cultures. And as an extension of that, I'm really trying to apply pressure to the idea of Europe itself. I mean, I think that Europe, like El Andalus, is both a place and an idea. And I think that the idea of Europe is when I put it in conversation with the idea of El Andalus, we immediately start to tease out some of the challenges or some of the pressures or fissures that we find in debates about what Europe is. Like, is Arabic a European language? Are Muslims a constitutive part of European culture or kind of somehow external or additions to it? I would argue that if you look at the long history of this region, and particularly the long history of Al-Andalus, it's really difficult to understand European history and identity without giving a really important place to Muslims and Arabs. And so I'm interested in this comparative operation, and I'm also interested in the ways in which this specific comparison opens up and challenges some of the underlying assumptions we might have about what it means to be European and who is included in that category. In terms of who the audience for the book is, you know, I aspired to write a book that someone who had never really heard very much about Al-Andalus ever before could pick up and start the book and read all the way through. I tried as hard as I could to write a book that didn't have too much jargon, that I actually forced myself to write a summary of the history of Al-Andalus in 3 or 4 pages at the beginning of the book, because I didn't want to assume that someone who picks up the book actually even knows what Al-Andalus is, where it was, what the major players are. And so I'm really trying to pull off something that's hard, and I'm still not sure if it's true, which is I'm trying to write a book that satisfies specialists of Al-Andalus, people who have spent their entire careers working on this, but that is also accessible to people who are curious about Al-Andalus, but maybe have only heard of it or have very little previous knowledge about it. And I'm still trying to figure out whether I hit that goal. But what I aspire to is to have written a book that is meaningful for people who are interested in Al-Andalus, in the cultural history of the Mediterranean world, in the history of the Muslim and Arab worlds, but also just to people who are interested in history in general. And I'm also curious about, you know, people who might be traveling to Spain or North Africa for the first time and want to know something about how these different regions are related to each other. I'm also hoping that the book might be of interest to those sorts of readers as well. So that's some of the ideas about audience I had in mind.
Thank you so much, Eric. And are you still planning to work on Al-Andalus, or what is your next project going to be?
Yes. So I'm now working on a new book. I'm actually here. We're talking today and I'm in Morocco. I'm here for 6 months now. And it's part of why I'm here is to launch work on a new book. After having written 2 books about Al-Andalus, I thought, I'll probably move on at least for now to work on some other things. But Al-Andalus has kind of got its claws in me long ago when I was a young person, and perhaps not surprisingly, I'm continuing to think about it. So my new book is related to Al-Andalus, but it's also framed a little bit differently. The book is about the history of multilingualism in the Mediterranean world, and particularly the history of multilingual art forms. So one of the things that people who study Al-Andalus might know, but might be unfamiliar to our listeners, is that Al-Andalus was this really multilingual place in which Arabic was the dominant language of culture and political power. But there were also all these other different languages circulating. So among them, Amazigh Berber, a kind of early form of what is today Spanish, we could call like proto-Romance, Hebrew, Latin, and so on. And some of the major literary forms of Al-Andalus were very playful with mixing these different languages that were being used in Al-Andalus. You have different literary forms that would be, say, predominantly in Arabic, but might have rhyme words in another language, or might have part of the poem in another language. It might start in Arabic and end in something else. And so when I teach those literary forms to my students, they often find them very challenging, whether or not they can even read them, even just trying to think about what does it mean to write a poem in multiple languages, who is this for? Usually my students find this to be a kind of oddity about the past. And one of the ways I try to make that oddity more legible or seem like more accessible to the ways in which we produce culture today is I teach them alongside other multilingual art forms from the 21st century, and in particular hip hop. Because if you look at 21st century hip hop, particularly from North Africa and the Mediterranean region, you also have all these different kinds of code switching practices. You might have an artist who raps predominantly in Arabic, but builds rhymes between Arabic, French, and Spanish, and so on. And so what started off really as a pedagogical project, like how do I teach students about weird multilingual practices in the past by thinking about examples in the present, has turned into a scholarly project, which is like, how do I think about the long history of multilingual creativity in the Mediterranean? What are the continuities and what are the discontinuities? When and why might it be helpful to think about, say, an Andalusi zejel, which is one form of Andalusi poetry that has a bunch of words in Arabic and other languages alongside a 21st century Moroccan rap song where the lyrics are in Arabic and Spanish and French and English? What are the advantages and disadvantages of thinking about multilingualism across a kind of a 10th century or 11th century span? And I would say that the other kind of driver of that project is like a lot of histories of the Mediterranean world are built around either nation state, a religious group, or a single language. And I'm trying to ask in that book, what does it mean to take multilingualism, the actual mixing of languages, as like, oh, the primary engine for understanding the development of Mediterranean cultural history? So it's like trying to retell the history of the Mediterranean world with multilingualism, not as a kind of marginal oddity, but at the center of the Mediterranean experience. And so that's what I'm working on now. And Al-Andalus is certainly one part of that project.
Thank you so much, Eric. That sounds fascinating. And we've come to the end of our podcast. So I wanted to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today about your book.
Thank you so much for the opportunity and thanks for reading. It was great to talk to you.